Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. After establishing itself as an agricultural superpower, the Egyptian world developed at a frenetic pace to usher in the period of time known as the Old Kingdom. Highlighted by powerful pharaohs and endless building projects, the office known as the Great House became a staple of Egyptian life and a primary feature of the Egyptian world. For centuries, these leaders constructed massive buildings in their own names, until eventually their already waning support collapsed beneath their feet. On this episode, we discuss the Old Kingdom. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On Season 2 of the series, we're discussing the great empires of the ancient world, the forces that created and destroyed them, and the legacies they leave behind that help shape our modern world. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, bradykreitzer.com, and your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. In the last episode, we began our discussion of ancient Egypt, a mysterious land that has captivated the imagination of Westerners and foreigners for generations. We began very simply by discussing the mentality of the Egyptian people, discussing the flair and flavor of the Egyptian people, having a better sense of how individuals in the ancient world, particularly the Nile River Valley, perceive their own world. Today, we'll begin our discussion of the historical chronology of ancient Egypt, and I think this is going to be done even in a cursory way. There's so much we could talk about, and there's so much we're going to skip over based on necessity, that there is always room for further investigation on your own. But the history of Egypt, very simply, is the history of a river valley and a people who live there. The Nile River, over 4,000 miles long, will be the lifeblood of the Egyptian people. It floods on a regular, predictable basis. It's highly predictable. So the people who live there have that unique ability to plan their lives around it. They plan their domestic life around it. They plan their economic and financial life around it. It's a privilege that is had nowhere else in the region. And by looking to the Mesopotamians, who have their own flooding river valley, one that floods on an irregular basis, we've already seen the trouble that can create in the form of competition, and of course the natural byproduct of competition, warfare. Now, today's episode is going to be based on how we as historians discuss the Egyptian world. It is a long history. It's a tumultuous history. It's a glorious history. And what we as historians seek to do is to take all that information and break it down by compartmentalization, by making it easy, by making it accessible, by making it, therefore, easier to understand. Egypt's timeline is filled with one achievement after another. But I also think it's filled with the notion that after every major achievement, after every major period of grace, you have perhaps a catastrophic lesson learned the hard way. That is a lesson that hopefully stays with us in the modern world. So we'll talk for the first part of the podcast about how we make sense of this time period, how we break this down, and what we can gain from it. We talked in the last episode about the fact that the highest ranking political office in the Egyptian world is that of pharaoh. Now, pharaoh was a term we've all heard before, but it was a position not just of politics, not just of power, but also religious devotion and dependence. To be the pharaoh was not just to be the king, and was not just to be the emperor, and we will see Egypt emerge as an empire in this episode, but to be Pharaoh was to be a living god himself. Not a representative god, not someone selected by the divine, but a god himself. We haven't seen that anywhere else in the world at this time. In the Mesopotamian way of life, the gods were always a factor, but the kings have always said they were selected by God based on their abilities. They were handpicked, but they were never so bold as to say that they were gods themselves. That's going to happen in Egypt, and this will set a new precedent in the world as we see moving forward. But being a living god was part of being the Pharaoh. Remember, Pharaoh in ancient Egypt will translate to the great house. And you are a keeper of all worldly things at that point. Yes, riches. Yes, gold. Yes, power. But also other societal virtues. Things like justice. Things like fairness. Things that most people would say require a civilized society to advance further ahead in the future. It's all part of being the Pharaoh at the time. But other parts of being Pharaoh, and this is very real in the ancient world, is understanding that you're only as great as the legacy you leave behind, because in your world, someone came before you, and someone will come after you. That's the idea. Power is consolidated in the hands of one place and one very small group of people. So when we as historians look at this, we see over 31 different, not pharaohs, but ruling families in Egyptian history over a period of about 3,000 years. 31 ruling families. Again, we call those dynasties. So how do we make sense of this? Because every pharaoh has difficult decisions to make. And like politicians today, we can say every pharaoh has their own policy agenda. While the way that historians deal with this, historians, archaeologists, and Egyptologists, if you want to use that word, these individuals will break down Egyptian history, again, into smaller eras or compartments. Make it easy, we'll call them kingdoms. Historians will break down the Old Kingdom, the Middle Kingdom, and the New Kingdom. It's not terribly difficult, but that basic guideline has allowed us to get a much bigger picture by really tearing down and breaking apart each individual period on its own. Remember, for the most part, not always, but for the most part, they're all governed by the same institution, that pharaonic institution. And as historians, all we really have to do is understand the different policies, understand how they reflect the different time periods, or perhaps influence the different time periods. And we can take a very big and very challenging idea like the history of ancient Egypt and make it very simple. Or in the least, make it much easier for us to grasp. On today's episode, we're going to focus on the Old Kingdom of Egyptian history. Because I think we'll see a lot of how the information we've dealt with so far, not only on ancient Egypt, but also on the ancient world, has really allowed the Old Kingdom of Egypt to flourish in the way that it does. The way we're going to talk about the Old Kingdom of Egypt today is going to be through a way that is highly stylized, very popular, but I also think very meritous. And it's by talking about the development of one of the most iconic images in the world, and certainly the number one reference of Egypt on the planet, visually speaking. And that, of course, is the pyramid. The pyramid did not fall from the sky. The pyramid is a science and an art, but it certainly wasn't easily accomplished. The pyramid as we know it was the greatest architectural achievement in the world at the time it was created, but it was a very difficult and very tedious process that was dictated by a huge volume of trial and error. Now, that's a very expensive trial and error and a very cumbersome and brutally difficult trial and error when it goes the wrong way. But what you finish with at the end of this episode, this pyramid structure, will be really a defining symbol for the Egyptian world, not just in the way it looks and the way it's built, but by how it's perceived and how it equates to power and standing in the world. Because the same decisions that influence how and why a pyramid is built will be made by the same people often for the same reasons that in the future we'll see wars declared. We'll see major policy decisions changed. We'll see royal families eliminated, and we'll see individuals killed. So I think this is a really great way to introduce ourselves to the Old Kingdom, the development of the pyramids. Because even in that development, you really do see the story of the time. Now, the Old Kingdom of Egypt is a place of prosperity, relatively speaking. It takes us back a bit, but here's what we've seen so far. For about 1,000 years, the Egyptian world has been built on a stable and steady agricultural economy. The people are doing well, the money is there, they're growing, and they're realizing the system they have works. Remember, anywhere the Nile River floods, a relatively straight shot, flowing south to north, you see cities and towns flourish and develop. But even more than that, now after 1,000 years, you're beginning to see human beings in the region really take charge for themselves. Remember, if the river's not there, it's simply inhospitable for living. Only 5% of Egyptian soil is livable, based on those standards. But what we see people begin to do at this time is really, again, take matters into their own hands. They know the river brings life, they know the river brings opportunity, and they begin massive canal building projects on perpendicular lines, east and west, jutting out of the Nile River. What they're doing is literally rerouting a river in some cases, allowing that life-giving water, that life-giving flood, to bring life and opportunity to new parts of the region. So we don't want to say the Old Kingdom is a high point of Egyptian civilization. It's really not. But it's not quite a formative period either. It's really the first time that the Egyptian system with a pharaoh, with what we'd consider to be an advanced culture and advanced government, is really beginning to take command and really beginning to reap the benefits of all the hard work that's come from before, whether those be natural benefits or man-made political benefits. The person we're going to begin our discussion with in the Old Kingdom, because there are numerous pharaohs we will not talk about in this series, will be a pharaoh with about a 25-year reign, a little more, we think, named Djoser. Djoser, as pharaoh, begins to understand the power that he has and the power and responsibility that he really has to present. We talked in the previous episode about the glorious appearance of the pharaoh, decked out in gold, decked out in jewels, decked out in rubies. When someone sees the pharaoh, they are literally seeing a living god. And in Djoser's mind, they have to bow in reverence to him. So he is one of these people that really takes that living god, glorious appearance to another level. The way he looks, the gold, the jewels, the rubies, the diamonds, ensures that he will be worshipped in life. But Djoser's big problem, and hey, we've all been there, is, will my people worship me in death the same way they worship me in life? Well, he's already seen from previous pharaohs, you're basically dead, and for the most part forgotten about. But he wants to leave behind some physical manifestation of his power, because those gold and those jewels and those diamonds will disappear whenever his body disappears. Realistically, they probably end up on the black market somewhere. But this is Djoser's dilemma. I'm a very important figure in life. How do I maintain that momentum in death? Because remember the Egyptian view of the afterlife. Death was not the end of anything. Death was not the beginning of some tormentous existence, like we saw in other parts of the world. But death was a very pleasant transition to a much more pleasant world. Again, a transition really only reserved for the super rich, for the pharaonic members and the priests. But it was there nevertheless. So this is Djoser's dilemma. How will he do this? Well, he has to look at where the goods come from. And again, here we see the first real beauties of empire, I suppose you can say, beginning to emerge. One of the things about empire that you have to understand is that the features of everyday life of the metropole, of the heart of the empire, would probably not be possible without the larger empire itself. Okay? Consider the British Empire, for example. There is no one single drink, I think, more indicative of the British Empire than tea. Then you factor in the idea that there is not one ounce of tea grown in the British Isles. Most of it comes from the Far East. And you see the issue. something as beneficial, something as critical to their material culture as tea is something that they would never have if their empire did not reach the farthest reaches of the world. So those are all the problems of an imperial world, first world problems, I suppose we could say. But that's what you see, and you're at a period with Egypt where you're really beginning to see that emerge. Again, the Old Kingdom is not a formative period, but it is an early period, but they are realizing their potential. Gold is not harvested or mined in Egypt itself, not Egypt proper. If you want gold, you have to go south to the Kingdom of Nubia. Today, we would consider these to be the nations of Sudan and South Sudan, but Nubia was always a critical part of the Egyptian economy, sometimes as trading partners, sometimes as vassals, as the conquered people. But as a neighbor and an African neighbor and an important African neighbor, they were always there. So again, you have these riches, these gold, these jewels. These things are coming from the south. They're coming from a non-Egyptian place. And again, really only consumed by the elite, but not possibly consumed without empire. So Djoser looks at his dilemma. How will he leave behind his lasting legacy in the world? How will he leave something behind so that the Egyptian people and anyone else who comes in the region will never forget his name? Well, here we see the idea, the birth at the earliest conception of the notion of a pyramid. Now, the shape and design is something you have to throw out the window with Djoser. It's just not there yet. But the desire for being remembered, the ego, perhaps the responsibilities of the pharaonic office, all of these things will push Djoser toward that decision. Now, the development of the pyramid is a very fascinating one, not only in how it's built, but how it's designed, because it was never what I would describe as an intentional design, at least not in the offset. Usually, like all great projects, it's something that developed and evolved over time. In our modern world, architects will design buildings that need to be built in a very specific way. But during this time period, they knew they were trying to build something grand. They weren't sure what it would turn into. And I love this story. So here's what we can say. Djoser will employ the workings of an architect named Imhotep. If you've ever heard the name Imhotep, it's fairly popular in the modern age. If from nothing else, but from the Brendan Fraser movie, The Mummy, the Pharaoh in the movie, The Mummy, which was non-existent, obviously, was named Imhotep. And it always makes me laugh. Because when you know who the actual Imhotep was, making him a pharaoh is sort of silly. I'm not the kind of person, on a personal note, that ever criticizes or makes fun of movies. Movies are entertainment. They're designed to entertain. If you really want to learn something, read a book. But movies are fine. They play a very interesting role. They bring a lot of people to the table. So I understand the value of a good movie. But I also appreciate the humor of it when I see it. But Imhotep's a fascinating character for Djoser. Again, Djoser is the pharaoh. And Imhotep is much more than just an architect. Imhotep would be considered to be a vizier. Now, what's a vizier? Well, a vizier is sort of, maybe you could say, a prime minister of Egypt. He's a close personal confidant of Djoser. He's someone who helps craft policy. He's someone who will, quite frankly, sway at times the pharaoh, at times more than others, in toward a decision. I mean, he very much has the ear of the pharaoh. Now, depending on who the pharaoh is and who the vizier is, you'll see less powerful viziers or more powerful viziers. But they're always that voice of reason, perhaps, for the pharaoh, someone to bounce ideas off of, someone to craft policy off of. But Imhotep sets out to build Djoser the most grand, the most beautiful, the most unforgettable tomb complex that Egypt's ever seen. And in the process, he's actually filling a critical step in the design that won't be finished for some time toward what we know today as the modern pyramid. Now, to understand Imhotep's thinking and why he's trying to please Djoser the way he is, you have to understand how people are buried royalty at the time. The most common method of burial at this period of the Old Kingdom in the ancient world, in the ancient Egypt, is burial not in a pyramid, but in a stone structure known as a mastaba. Now, a mastaba, if you want to think of it, is like a giant shoebox. It's a large rectangular structure. It has rooms, it has various passages. But the real benefit of the mastaba, the real burial site of the mastaba, is underground. There are typically on the surface a very large rectangular structure. Underneath it, you have tunnels with chambers where royalty will be buried. Now, why is that important? Well, it goes directly into the thought process of the architect himself. Imhotep wants to build the finest mastaba that the ancient world's ever seen. And he begins to make various designs. He takes one large mastaba, and he wonders how he can spice it up, how he can make it something unforgettable. So he stacks a smaller mastaba on top of it. As he continues to look at it, he realizes what he's working on, and he'll stack a subsequent smaller mastaba on that, and a smaller one on that, and a smaller one on that. And what he makes is the world's most expensive wedding cake, effectively, if you want to view this in a way we can understand. It's not a pyramid, it doesn't have smooth sides, not by any stretch of the imagination, but it's effectively one mastaba stacked on top of the other. And it goes from a very wide base to a very narrow top. And what this is an early yet very imperfect pyramid. And when Djoser sees it, he thinks, this is something I've never seen before. This is something I've never experienced before. This will be my lasting legacy. And he'll ride that into the great beyond that is the Egyptian afterlife. As historians, we'll call this the Step Pyramid, obviously from the Step design. Again, visualize a wedding cake. You can find images of all of these constructions online. But we call it the Step Pyramid of Saqqara. It's built in Saqqara in the Egyptian desert. But what most people tend to not grasp when they see it, I think, are a few of the most important elements. They all see it as that sort of proto-pyramid, that next step towards something we'll recognize as a pyramid. But they really fail to grasp the magnitude of it. Because by most accounts, the Step Pyramid of Saqqara is, by what we found, the very first stone structure ever built in the history of the world. The very first lasting stone structure ever built in the history of the world. It's amazing when you consider what's going on in other parts of the region. But that's the interesting thing about the Step Pyramid of Saqqara. The other thing is that the real mysteries of the period, the real grandeur of the period, as amazing as what you see with your eyes is what's underneath it. Because underneath it, you have a massive subterranean funerary complex. There is one major shaft that goes down into the ground. And then in each of the four cardinal directions, you see an additional room. These shafts would be filled with treasure. They'd be filled with the bodies of those close to Djoser. They'd be, again, the location of Djoser's remains himself. And we talked a bit about mummification in the previous episode. But the Step Pyramid of Saqqara, perhaps, and very likely, the very first massive stone structure ever built in the history of the world, is a milestone, no pun intended, for a lot of different reasons. It not only shows that the Egyptians are advancing architecturally, that they're challenging the norms of physics, but it also shows that it can be done. Now, how did they do it? Well, the Egyptians rarely used what we would think of as slave labor. Slave labor, the way we know it here in the West, was not probably the system they used in Egypt. They would sometimes employ prisoners of war to take on projects like this. And that's something that we know Djoser did do. But that was not the majority of workers. In fact, that was a very small minority of workers. The very vast majority of the workers who built this building were what we'd consider to be corvée laborers. They were paid for their efforts. Now, some of them were just given tax breaks. Not many of them were actually given currency. Some were given food, some were given supplies, but they were not working in a slave-like fashion. They were given reward for their work. So I think that's worth noting as well. But to build this edifice required a huge amount of ingenuity itself, not just constructing it, but actually gaining the materials needed to build it. What we typically see through the use of bronze tools were large pieces of stone cut out and then dragged to their location. Now, how did they do it? People look at the ancient Egyptian pyramids, And they say from our modern view that these people of the ancient world, as backwards and as different and as behind as they were, could never have built such a thing. They could never have built such a thing. And because of that, we come up with these bizarre theories. And you'll find them on television. Again, always be wary of your history you get on television, saying that, you know, aliens built the pyramid and all of these bizarre things. There's a very few very big problems with that statement. Number one, scientifically, is that we haven't proven the existence of aliens, so therefore you really can't use that as a starting point. And I'm not saying if they do or don't exist. But we also know that it really doesn't give the ancient world, more importantly, and the people of the ancient world, enough credit for what they actually accomplished. Because just like today, there are geniuses in the ancient world, and there are also individuals who aren't so intelligent. If you think you're so much more advanced than the ancients, let me ask you this. You have an iPhone, you must be more advanced than them. Go ahead and build me one. Odds are most of the technology you have no idea how it works. I'm not even sure how this podcast works, to be honest with you. But you were given by someone else. You were born in a beneficial age of technology. Well, they had intelligent people as well, and they used innovation to accomplish these massive goals. Typically, what they would do is lay wet mud on the ground and drag, to avoid the less friction, the large stones toward their position. That's what we would say, after the stone is quarried. But the Step Pyramid of Saqqara is a major step in the direction we consider to be the construction of a pyramid. And it really shows how the pharaohs of the Old Kingdom are viewing their power and their world. They need physical displays of wealth. They need physical reminders that they are the living God, that they are supreme, that they are central to the Egyptian world. And the pharaoh is a big part of that. Now, Djoser will be buried under his step pyramid, and he'll retire to the sands of time. But that desire doesn't go away, not by a long shot. And when other pharaohs see what Djoser's done, this very rough, but still very proto-pyramid, they'll want it too. And they'll want to do it bigger, and they'll want to do it better. And this will be a guiding principle in the time period. The pharaoh we're going to talk about next was named Sneferu. Sneferu as an individual is obsessed with his own power. And he's obsessed with his own view of things. And he believes he has a systematic way of accomplishing it. Now, when Sneferu takes over, he's all about expanding his own domain. He raids into Nubia in the south. He leads military raids into Libya to the northwest. And he does it in such a way, we can say perhaps, that he lowers himself to gain power. He stoops to power. He goes to the people of Egypt, and he doesn't say to them, "I am the God, I am the Great One, worship me." He wants all of those things. But he lowers himself by talking about the Egyptian world as a we more than a me. We don't want to take this too far, but he's a consummate politician. He gives the people a sense that I'm one of you. Because what he's trying to convince them to do is about to engage into some massive public spending projects, whether they be military campaigns, or as we're concerned with, building projects. Whenever he sees Djoser's pyramid, all Sneferu can think about is how to do it bigger and how to do it better. And he selects a place in the Egyptian desert called Meidun for his great pyramid. And he builds it. He commissions it. It's very expensive, but it's a step to, perhaps we can say, smooth out the edges of the step pyramid. The pyramid of Meidun is very thin and very tall compared to what we'll see the final product of a pyramid looks like. He has it constructed. He has it built. And what we see over time is that the pyramid of Meidun collapses. Now, what we have today is the aftermath. If you saw the structure built at Meidun by Sneferu, you never view it as a pyramid. It looks like a tall, thin tower surrounded by a huge pile of rubble and sand and rocks. Okay, but what that huge pile of rubble and sand and rocks really is, was the outer coating of the pyramid that he designed. He built the pyramid to be so narrow and so steep that for a while it probably did look like what we'd consider to be a pyramid. But over time, those outer layers of polished limestone that really gave it a nice finish slid off the edges and crumbled into a pile beneath, and all you really have left is like this framework structure. Now, what we can say is, Snefru had the right idea. He knew what he wanted the finished product to look like, but he didn't understand the physics of it. He didn't understand the design elements of it to make it sustainable. Now, we don't know how long it took for that building to collapse. We really don't. Because when you look at it, it would appear like it happened right away. And the fact that he'll engage in other attempts would lead you to believe that he wasn't happy with the outcome. But there are some later documents, particularly from the New Kingdom of Egypt. Again, this is the Old Kingdom. That does talk about the beauty of that pyramid. So if the Meidum pyramid did crumble right away, it's very unlikely that a later visitor to Egypt would see it and describe it in the complimentary way that he did. The fact of the matter is, we'll never know whether the Meidum pyramid collapsed on its own immediately or long after Snefru's life, but we do know it did collapse, and it collapsed because the angle was simply too steep, and the building materials on the outside had not enough friction for it to hold onto, to cling onto, to settle. So Snefru will not be detracted. He will not be the pharaoh who tried to build a pyramid, and who built one so large that even the ruins of it were too big to remove. So he picked another location called Dashur, and there he built another pyramid. Now remember, these pyramids take a huge amount of time to build. They take a huge amount of money to build, and a huge amount of human capital to build. It's not easy to build one of these. People will die in the process. But he builds his new pyramid at Dashur, and he widens the base. He's learned his lesson from his previous pyramid at Meidum. But the problem he has now is that midway through the construction, things begin to change. We aren't sure why. Could have been political circumstances. It could have been the emergence of a new outside threat. It could have been any number of things. But midway through the construction of the Dashur pyramid, we see Snefru change the design of the structure. And when you see this pyramid, it is bizarre. Because the entire base of the pyramid, in fact, the first half of the pyramid, is built at an angle of about 53 degrees, roughly speaking, around there. And then halfway through the pyramid, Snefru drastically changes the angle of ascent to something like 40 to 43 degrees. So the pyramid descends at two completely different angles, and because of that, it becomes known as the Bent Pyramid. The Bent Pyramid. But he does try to finish it off, even though it looks unusual and looks very awkward. And he coats the outside with polished limestone. Now, here's something we have to grasp, and we'll reference it a lot in the future. But when we see the ruins of the ancient world, far too many people have some strange idea that the ruins were at one time the final product. If you see these pyramids, they're rocky, they're dirty, they're dusty, they're abandoned. There is nothing glorious other than the size about their appearance. And it wouldn't have been glorious at the time either. People are still sensible, they still have sensibilities and need to be met. Every pyramid you would have seen, and Egypt has upwards of 36 of them at this point, today. Of course, it's still very new in the time period we're talking about, would have polished white limestone all around the outside of the structure, hand polish. So when you see it, it was almost smooth as glass and had the shimmering and awe-inspiring white texture to it. It really would have been impressive. It really would have been impressive. And if you have the chance to see the Bent Pyramid of Dashur, if you approach it, most of that polished white limestone is gone from the upper parts. But still around the base on certain spaces, you can still see some of that polished white limestone in its original position. And when you look at it, you're looking at it from the bottom up, and you would swear you're looking at white glass, frosted white glass. It's just that smooth. So clearly, highly specialized labor went into creating that. But what we have still are now three pyramids in Egypt. You have the Step Pyramid of Saqqara, of Djoser, more like a wedding cake, no smooth edges. You have the crumbled failure that was the pyramid at Meidum. And now you have Snefru trying again But changing the angle and having this very awkward but stable, it's still there to this day, pyramid at Deshur. Now, Snefru is not happy with this. Again, when people see it, they say, yeah, I suppose it's nice because it's staying. And yes, the edges are smooth. But the change of angle makes it look so unusual for Snefru that he just can't justify not trying one more time. So again, he goes to the place he has to remain in power. He goes to the people. He lowers himself. He talks to them about what he wants to do. He needs to spend public money on this creation. And what he achieves is what we'd consider to be the first true, stable, and symmetrical pyramid known as the Red Pyramid. And if you see the Red Pyramid, it's certainly not the biggest building. It's certainly not the most famous, but it's probably the most often overlooked. Because let's face it, the trial and error stories of Snefru's earlier opportunities and earlier attempts really make a better story. But the Red Pyramid he builds only about a mile from Dashur, from the Bent Pyramid, is the first pyramid. It's the first true pyramid. And it will set the stage for all other pharaohs in the future. That's what they want to mimic. So between Djoser and Snefru, we see the pyramid emerge. Again, for the ancient alien theorists, that story is not nearly as much fun. But it's such a compelling story that it's almost better in that way, because one, it's true, and two, it shows the triumph of human engineering and human imagination. But it is a process of trial and error. Remember, Saqqara, the Step Pyramid, was the first stone structure ever built by man, 1,000 years before even Stonehenge. So consider that for a while, the age we're dealing with here. But it will next fall to the son of Snefru, a pharaoh named Khufu. The Greeks will refer to him as Cheops. You may have heard him by either name. Khufu is his Egyptian name. To really take this a step further into the great beyond. And what Khufu builds, in his own honor, of course, is what we think of today as the Great Pyramid of Giza. It is the pyramid art perfected. The trial and error period is over. You know what you're doing from the outset. And you can make something bigger and better than anyone ever has. If you see the Great Pyramid of Giza, what you'll find is that there's not one pyramid, large pyramid, but actually three. And that's because the Great Pyramid was so renowned that Khufu's son Khafre and his grandson Menkaure would actually build their own pyramids nearby. That's what you see, but Khufu's is the granddaddy of them all. Again, no pun intended. This is where you see the Great Sphinx built in front of the Great Pyramid. That was most likely a representation of Khafre. We don't know for sure, but we're pretty certain. It certainly had nothing to do with Khufu, but probably Khafre. But at any rate, that's the process we see. Now, why did we spend a whole episode talking about it? Well, it gives us a great opportunity to kind of see the development of Egypt in a microcosm. Egypt writ small. Egypt is a powerful place in the Old Kingdom. Egypt is a place that has the benefit of being an empire, but it's still at a stage where it hasn't achieved its fullest achievement yet. It's not in a formative period, because you can take the project on, but they still haven't become what they will in the future. And when you follow the steps of these pyramids, you really see the emergence of a people on the rise, leading to what will be considered to be a golden age of their existence. When the Old Kingdom ends, the Middle Kingdom begins, and socially, culturally, economically, it is a very different place, the Middle Kingdom, than the Old Kingdom ever was. On the next episode, we're going to talk about the Middle Kingdom of the Egyptian world, because it's viewed again as a high point in their culture. But the transition is maybe just as important as the result. The Old Kingdom pharaohs, if you took anything from this, they like to spend money. They like to spend money that's not necessarily theirs, through taxation, so on and so forth. The money garnered to build the pyramids often came from the wealthy elite of the countryside. And what you began to see was the building, the expenditure, but also the wars in foreign territories put so much stress and pressure on the pharaonic dynasties of the Old Kingdom that their power began to wane, and very quickly, the power of the local elites began to grow. What you'll see is actually the fall of the Pharaonic dynasty of the Old Kingdom at this point. And power that used to be in the hands of the one is now spread in the hands of the few. This is not a democracy in Egypt, but what you have are small ruling families all throughout the different regions of the empire, really gaining their own power. And when they do that, they begin to govern their own territories. They set their own laws, they set their own taxes, as they would like. Okay, it's not a federal system, not like the United States has, because the federal government would have been gone at that point. But we begin to see a prosperity emerge from Egypt at that time. Because again, the spending was so great in the Old Kingdom. We'll call this the intermediary period between the Old Kingdom and the Middle Kingdom. But this intermediary period is really defined by small local elites making rules for themselves and their own people. And there actually is a huge economic boom from this in Egypt, so much so that it ushers in an entirely new period of not just economic prosperity, but cultural advancement, cultural diversity, and societal development. It's really a fascinating story. On the next episode, we'll discuss Egypt's Middle Kingdom. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.